This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Biotech ROI, Measuring the Success of North Carolina's Taxpayer-Supported Loan Program. And that's the headline for the cover story that actually begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a second headline, Banking on Biotech, One Small Loan at a Time. And this article is written by Jason DeBruin. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center touts that, on average, every dollar it loans to a life sciences company is met with $112 of additional subsequent investment. It's hard to imagine a company that would scoff at that return on investment, but it's just an average. In fact, many companies raise very little additional capital. For every firm that has gone on to raise more than $100 million, there are 8 that have raised less than $1 million. 7% of companies that have received NC biotech loans account for 70% of all subsequent funding. While NC Biotech's mission is to provide, quote, long-term economic and societal benefits to North Carolina through support of biotechnology research, business, education, and strategic policy statewide, unquote, direct impact of the loan program can be difficult to measure. To be sure, life sciences is not a small industry here. The state has 600 biotech companies, including 350 in research and development, 125 in contract research and testing, and 110 in production and manufacturing. These collectively employ 60,000 workers with an average salary of $78,000. But a closer look at the multi-year data on loans made, company longevity, and success failure history reveals that only a small percentage of participating biotech firms can be considered big winners under NC Biotech's current strategy. And the biggest successes don't always benefit the greater North Carolina economy. How it works. With funds from the General Assembly, NC Biotech makes loans to small life sciences companies to help get them off the ground. These loans range from tens of thousands to $250,000, but rarely more. Companies then use that money to put together enough data to convince venture capitalists to invest. To receive NC Biotech funding, companies fill out a lengthy application and go through a rigorous review from program staffers who often solicit input from outside experts on both technical and business elements of the application. We invest significantly more effort into reviewing loan applications than a typical private investor would for investments of similar size because, one, we are very careful to be good stewards of the money that the General Assembly entrusts to us, and two, we are often the first investors to examine these companies in detail, says Joe Nixon, who leads the Business and Technology Development, BTD, team, responsible for supporting the startup and growth of life sciences companies in North Carolina. Since making its first loan in 1989, NC Biotech has made 253 loans to 175 companies, totaling $30.4 million. Those companies have gone on to raise at least $3.4 billion in subsequent funding, mostly from VC groups, through public offerings or acquisitions. Because NC Biotech strictly makes loans, it doesn't take equity. There is limited upside for a direct return, although the center argues that the benefit comes back to the state as those subsequent investments bring dollars into North Carolina. In many ways, its mission is to help drive North Carolina's economy forward. NC Biotech's loan terms are typically 3 years at a rate of prime plus 3%. Of every $5 loaned, $4 is repaid, a rate that Nixon calls remarkable. Upside and downside. There have been both successes and losses. Of the $3.4 billion in subsequent funding, $2.1 billion is concentrated in 12 companies. Some 95 companies, more than half that received NC Biotech loans, have gone on to raise less than $1 million each. Furthermore, even the success stories don't always last. Consider hepatitis C drug developer BioLex Incorporated, which raised $214 million after a small $100,000 boost from NC Biotech. Its last debt financing came in late 2011, but only 7 months later it filed for bankruptcy liquidation. Another example is Advanced Liquid Logic, a diagnostics company that spun out of Duke University and was acquired by San Diego-based genetics firm Illumina for $96 million in 2013. But specific integration plans for employees were not disclosed, and by 2015, Illumina did not employ any workers in North Carolina. Lipo Science is another. After receiving less than $100,000 from NC Biotech, it was able to raise more than $107 million, including $45 million by going public. After it was unable to gain traction with health insurance carriers to favor its blood test that executives said was a better predictor of heart attack risk, it sold to LabCorp for a value less than half its one-time high. LabCorp has not disclosed information about former LipoScience workers or executives. That's not to say acquisitions always portend bad things for North Carolina or the Triangle. TransZyme Pharma received $150,000 from NC Biotech and later raised $146 million, including $54 million through an IPO. The company merged with Palo Alto-based Osera Therapeutics, and while the management team moved to California and the company kept the Osera name, TransZyme was largely the remaining entity. All the drug development happens in Research Triangle Park, and the team has grown its scientific staff to 10, all located in the Triangle. Merck acquired Inspire, which received NC Biotech money. Although Merck doesn't break out specific employment numbers related to the former Inspire, it still employs some 2,300 people in the state. Embrex went through multiple steps since receiving $40,000 from NC Biotech. That included a $155 million acquisition by Pfizer, which then spun out Zoetis and included Embrex under that banner. Zoetis still employs 170 workers between an office in Durham and a manufacturing facility in Laurinburg. Of course, NC Biotech funding isn't necessary for success. Durham drug developer Parian Sciences just in June reached a licensing deal for a possible cystic fibrosis treatment with Boston-based Vertex Pharmaceuticals that will bring the Durham company $80 million upfront and could bring more than $1 billion in a best-case scenario. Parian did not receive a loan from NC Biotech. Supporters rally. It's not hard to find supporters of NC Biotech, including Christy Schaffer of Hatteras Venture Partners and managing director of its Hatteras Discovery Unit that invests in early-stage companies. She says venture groups can partner with NC Biotech and get almost a two-for-one in terms of due diligence, as both sides will do their own background work. That's what happened in the case of UNC Chapel Hill spin-out G1 Therapeutics, which received funding from both entities and has since gone on to raise more than $45 million in subsequent funding. Had it not been for the Biotech Center money coupling with us, it would have been harder, Schaefer says. For some other companies, she says, they really truly would not be able to get off the ground. NC Biotech appears to be regaining support in the General Assembly as well. For the 2014 to 2015 budget, NC Biotech received $13.6 million, of which only $8.6 million was recurring. The House approved budget would slot the full $13.6 million as recurring in next year's budget. However, that's down from $17.2 million all recurring in the 2012 to 2013 budget. With a total state budget of $20 billion, NC Biotech takes just a sliver. Not surprisingly, life sciences companies that receive NC Biotech funding support the organization, particularly because they don't have to give up equity. Getting funding for early stage assets is challenging, says Mark Valleca, CEO of G1 Therapeutics. It's always great to have non-dilutive capital. A risky industry. NC Biotech touts that 80% of the companies they invest in are still in business 10 years later. But these companies sometimes still carry risk that they will not ultimately pan out. Take one of the biggest success stories, Argos Therapeutics. It received only $10,000 from NC Biotech and went on to raise $300 million, first from venture groups and then an IPO. The company will soon employ 120 workers in Durham and is in the process of building a new headquarters there. But it still generates no commercial revenue. Indeed, among its risk factors, Argos concedes, conducting preclinical testing and clinical trials is a time-consuming, expensive, and uncertain process that takes years to complete, and we may never generate the necessary data or results required to obtain regulatory approval and achieve product sales. Our commercial revenues, if any, will be derived from sales of products that we do not expect to be commercially available for several years, if at all. Osera, the success story referenced earlier in this story, also has no commercial products on the market, and neither does G1 Therapeutics. Filling the funding gap. A drug developer must spend tens or hundreds of millions before the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approves the therapy or device. All this time, the company doesn't generate revenue on that asset, and it could fall apart completely if trials of the drug show it doesn't work the way initially hoped. However, there is money to be made. Consider a blockbuster drug that generates billions in sales. Investors like those in big venture capital groups look to life sciences companies for big returns, but want to minimize their risk exposure. So VC groups want some evidence that the product will work before making an investment. Getting that evidence requires a trial and error process that costs money. That's where the NC Biotech Center sees its role, investing early in these companies. If successful, they can parlay that into a much larger investment from a private group and grow to a large company that employs dozens of North Carolinians and creates wealth here. Compared with the life sciences meccas of San Francisco and Boston, North Carolina still lags in terms of investment. While universities and researchers attract billions each year from organizations like the National Institutes of Health, the state trails significantly in venture funding. Evaluating the model. Attracting biotech is something North Carolina should continue to pursue as a major sector in the state's economy. On average, the NC Biotech has been successful in raising add-on capital from private investors, which benefits the economy, but the touted return is lopsided based on the small percentage of companies accounting for most of the additional funding snagged by loan recipients. However, NC Biotech approaches its future funding strategy, one thing is clear: life sciences investing is risky, and even large sums of money don't guarantee long-term success. And along with this article, there are a number of graphs. The first one, life sciences investments by state from 2012 to 2015. Venture capital groups have poured more money into life sciences companies in California and Massachusetts than anywhere else. Listed are total investments in the life sciences industry by state according to PricewaterhouseCoopers National Venture Capital Association Money Tree Report. California, $10 billion. Massachusetts, $5.7 billion. Pennsylvania, $827 million. Texas, $764 million. And North Carolina, $523 million. The next graph, funding, a mixed success story. In its history, NC Biotech has made loans to 175 companies. Some have successfully raised millions in subsequent funding, others have not. Shown is a breakdown of what companies have raised in funding after an NC Biotech loan. Less than $1 million, 95 companies. Between $1 million and $5 million, 20 companies. Between $5 and $10 million, 13 companies. Between $10 and $20 million, 14 companies, $20 to $40 million, 12 companies, $40 to $100 million, 9 companies, and greater than $100 million, 12 companies. And finally, in a by the number section, 600-plus biotech companies include 350 research and development, 125 contract research and testing, 110 production and manufacturing, 60,000 employees with an average salary of $78,000, 7% employment growth through recession, 175 companies have received NC Biotech loans, 253 total loans have been awarded to companies, $30.4 million in loans awarded, $3.4 billion in subsequent funding to these companies, and $112.46 in subsequent funding raised on average for every $1 of NC Biotech investment. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Rebecca Troyer. Triangle Rock Club wins National Chamber Award. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce honored Triangle Rock Club, one of the fastest-growing companies in the Triangle, as the 2015 Dream Big Small Business of the Year. The honor comes with a $10,000 award. The Chamber chose Morrisville-based TRC from among seven regional finalists during America's Small Business Summit in Washington, D.C. TRC operates three indoor climbing gyms, including sites in North Raleigh and Fayetteville, in addition to the flagship in Morrisville, which in 2014 received a $2.5 million renovation and now features a 55-foot wall. The North Raleigh location includes 13,500 square feet of climbing area, a 30-foot freestanding climbing pillar, and more than 74 climbing lanes. The company has been growing quickly. In 2014, it recorded revenue of $2.43 million, up 61% from 2013. As recently as 2009, TRC's revenue was $366,000. Founder and managing partner Andrew Kratz is a former Marine and likes to joke that having two skill sets, climbing rocks and shooting guns, suited him well for opening a rock climbing club. As a side note, Joel Graybeal, the other managing partner, says there have been three marriage proposals at the business. Umstead to close section for major renovations. The five-star Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary will, in late June, close down its conference center wing for what will be the first major renovation of the space since the hotel opened in 2007. As part of the upgrade, the Umstead is also expanding its guest parking lot by 50%, adding an additional 60 spaces to accommodate larger event crowds booking the meeting space rooms. The conference center wing will shut down June 25, and the hotel's management expects it to reopen in September. The events wing has more than 10,000 square feet of meeting space and six room options. The upgrades will include new audiovisual equipment with 4K and Ultra HD technology, new carpets and other soft goods changes. An expanded section of the meeting space will add a high-tech meeting space called the Arbor Room. Enhancements to the hotel's terrace area will add a gas fire pit. This man hopes to turn donuts into dollars. Durham's Rise Biscuits and Donuts is moving forward with its franchising plans for nationwide expansion, but before tackling the world, they first want to tackle the rest of the Triangle. Ty Gwenap of Durham and his father, Tim Gwenap, have signed as Rise's first franchise owners and in early June started construction on what will be Rise's first franchise site at the Park West Village Retail Center in Mooresville. Ty Gwenap says the shop with a cult-like following should be opened in August. So what's his favorite Rise menu item? If I had to pick something from the everyday menu, I'd say the chicken biscuit and the cronut or cream brulee donut, Gwenap says. That's one of the best things about Rise is that my answer might be completely different next month. Golden Corral launches new campaign featuring comedian Jeff Foxworthy. Golden Corral, the Raleigh-based grill buffet restaurant chain, is launching a new nationwide advertising campaign featuring blue-collar comedy tour creator and comedian Jeff Foxworthy. Foxworthy will be promoting the restaurant's new breakfast for lunch and dinner promotion, reminding customers that during the summer months, Golden Corral will be offering breakfast foods on its buffet alongside its lunch and dinner dish options during all regular restaurant hours. Next Glass wants to help you make choices at Total Wine. Wilmington-based Next Glass has a new and powerful partner, Total Wine. The company, which develops an app that aims to pair you with wines that fit your own personal taste profile, is in talks with other retailers but is debuting this type of service initially with Total Wine and beer maker Heineken. When you walk into Total Wine stores, you'll get a list of all the things available to the user, says Next Glass CEO Kurt Taylor. App users will get a notification recognizing that they're in a Total Wine store and will be introduced to the highest rated bottle based on your taste. And finally, in the You Said It section, reader comments on recent TBJ stories. Anna Southern Living says Allen and Son Barbecue in Chapel Hill has the best barbecue in the South. The message from Smithsfields, NC at SCNBNC. Hey at Southern Living, what's up? We'll take the Pepsi challenge any day. Hashtag step up to the plate. Biogen Incorporated named number one green company by Newsweek. From Jocelyn Copus. Yes, I'm so proud to work for them. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The headline, Implus to expand at RTP, Liberty Property Trust to supply new industrial buildings. Liberty Property Trust, a Pennsylvania real estate investment trust with holdings across the triangle, has broken ground on two speculative industrial and flex buildings at Liberty Ridge near Research Triangle Park, and the developer in June will break ground on another new building for athletic gear company Implus Incorporated. Implus Corporation, the Durham-based footwear and athletic gear product company, is gearing up for an expansion of its brands and has linked a long-term lease deal to occupy all of a new 136,500-square-foot industrial building very near Implus's headquarters and distribution center at TW Alexander Drive. The new space will add 40% more distribution and office space for Implus in Durham, confirms Greg Stryker, director of marketing at the company. We have not yet solidified numbers on new hires with the build of the new space that will be used for offices and warehousing, says Stryker. Implus currently employs about 350 people nationwide, with more than 300 of those employees based at its Durham campus. Liberty's other two buildings underway at Liberty Ridge is a 58,500-square-foot building at 1951 TW Alexander Drive and a 126,000-square-foot building at 1953 TW Alexander Drive. Both buildings are expected to be completed in December, and both will be LEED certified. Buyer of Foster Street site in Durham plans six-story condo. The longtime owners of the 539 Muse building on Foster Street in downtown Durham have sold the one-acre site to a Chapel Hill development firm that's planning to build one of the largest residential condo projects in the Triangle in nearly 7 years. A partnership led by Ron Strom's Blue Heron Asset Management has paid $1.65 million for the property at the corner of Foster and Corporation Streets next to Durham Central Park and the historic Durham Athletic Park, according to Durham County Records. Site plans already filed with the city show designs for a six-story building with 92 residential condo units plus six three-story terrace homes. Design sketches by Klein Design of Raleigh, however, are still pending because Blue Heron and its partners have not settled on the final color scheme for the buildings. The sellers of the property were E.L. Denny Clark and his wife, Patricia Clark, who had owned the property since 1998. Mod Pizza to open first Triangle restaurant in July. Mod Pizza, A Seattle-based build-your-own pizza concept is opening its first Triangle restaurant at 2071 Millbrook Road in the new Harris Teeter-anchored shopping center at the corner of Millbrook and Creedmoor Roads in Raleigh. The restaurant will open in July. Taverna Agora moves to downtown Raleigh. Taverna Agora, a Greek restaurant that opened on Raleigh's Glenwood Avenue in 2003, has moved and opened in its new location in downtown Raleigh as of June 9. The new location at 326 Hillsborough Street, between the Second Empire Restaurant and the Round Holiday Inn, has been in the works for more than a year. Triangle Coffee retailer to open its fourth local shop. Joe Van Gogh, a Hillsborough-based coffee roaster and retailer, is opening its third location in Durham and the fourth in the Triangle. The new store, set to open in the fall, will be in the Woodcroft Shopping Center at 4711 Hope Valley Road in Durham. And in a section titled Breaking Ground, Palms Apartments Raised, New Project Begins. Demolition crews have finished tearing down the mid-1960s era The Palms apartment community on Lake Boone Trail in West Raleigh, and Raleigh real estate developer and owner Gordon Grubb says construction has officially begun on the luxury apartment community that will replace it. The new 283-unit community will be called Sojourn Lake Boone, and its first apartment units are expected to open by January 2016. The whole project is expected to be completed in late 2016. And finally, in a by-the-numbers section, top commercial real estate sales. Investors in the Triangle were hot for hotels in May. Of the nearly $469 million in major commercial property sales recorded in the Triangle during the month of May, nearly half were in hotel acquisitions. Hotels, 43% at $203 million. Apartments at 41%, $190 million. Offices at 12%, $55.3 million. And retail at 4%, $18.6 million. And we have a small question and answer column on the On Real Estate page with the headline, Guitar Shop Owner to Sell Building. Harry Tooting, owner of Harry's Guitar Shop and the single-story cinder block building at 616 Glenwood Avenue, where the business has been based since 1988, has decided to put the property up for sale and see what he can get for it. Tooting has hired a brokerage firm, DTZ of Morrisville, to market the quarter-acre site in the heart of downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District and is asking $1.7 million for the property, a price that is more than twice its property tax value, according to Wake County records. Your shop is a landmark in Glenwood South. Why are you looking to sell? Through no fault of our own, this has become part of a high-end neighborhood, and we don't need to be in a high-end neighborhood. It'd be nice to have easier parking and maybe be able to have an event after dark. If no one wants to buy our building, I'll just stay here. What was the neighborhood like back when you opened? It wasn't such a nice neighborhood. We became pretty skilled at dealing with homeless guys coming in to warm up, play guitars for a while, unless they were too drunk to deal with. About the only thing over here was a Western Sizzlin', and when they sold out, it was four or five restaurants before it became Mellow Mushroom. I like to think that I was the beginning of the change. I took an unused building and put it in use again. How did you first get into the guitar selling business? I was living in Chapel Hill in the early 1980s, working for the Boy Scouts and also playing in an acoustic duo. Probably not the best time for the acoustic movement, but we were busy doing gigs and we needed equipment. It took several trips to get what we needed. We were not being treated badly, just being disregarded. I told my partner, "I think I can do this better," so I did. What are some of the famous guitar players you've sold to? Oh, we've sold some to Tiff Merritt, Ryan Adams, Hootie and the Blowfish when they were in town, blues artist Joe Bonamassa, Audley Freed, now a guitar player with Sheryl Crow, used to teach here and worked here part-time. So you're just looking to sell the building, not the business? I'm a guitar player and I do still play. I'll be 59 this year and I'm nowhere near retirement. I don't believe it's worth doing business if it's not fun, and this has been a very enjoyable business to run. But nobody's going into the music business to make a lot of money. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page, written by Jason DeBrun. The main headline, MERS gets okay for hand enhancement treatment. A Raleigh-based competitor to Botox received approval to market a product for the use in hands for the first time the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has ever approved this kind of treatment for the hands. The FDA granted approval to MERS North America, the U.S. affiliate of Germany-based MERS Pharma Group, to market its product, Radies, for augmentation to correct volume loss in the dorsum of the hands, according to the approval. The face is the moneymaker, says Bill Humphreys, MERS North America president and CEO, but look at the hands to determine someone's age. MERS has a product called Xeomin to compete against allergens Botox. Now MERS sees this new approved indication for Radies as a way to differentiate itself in the market. To be sure, cosmetic surgeons have used these kinds of products in hands on an off-label basis, and Radies has been tested in hands during clinical trials. Still, Humphreys estimates that about 169,000 patients are seeking hand treatments, and MERS now becomes the only company allowed to market for that indication. Surgeons also use a procedure called fat grafting to cosmetically enhance hands, though physicians who attended MERS's approval announcement said that that procedure takes longer and doesn't have the same effect. The injection treatment takes about 15 minutes compared to a 90-minute procedure for fat grafting. Benefits of the injection run out after about a year. In terms of a product launch, MERS doesn't plan on anything dramatic, largely because Radies has already been on the market, and the new indication simply expands the approved uses. MERS employs 500 sales representatives in the United States, about 100 of which specialize in selling Radies. MERS, a privately held company, has not released sales projections. A wild week for Chapel Hill's Posen. Chapel Hill drug developer Posen had a wild ride this week, culminating in a decision announced June 8 to merge with a Canadian company and move headquarters to Ireland. Posen will acquire Tribute Pharmaceuticals Canada Incorporated in a deal valued at $146 million and form a new company named Aralez Pharmaceuticals, domiciled in Ireland. The announcement comes just 1 week after founder and longtime CEO John Placeka resigned all his positions with the company. In addition, a syndicate of healthcare investors, led by Deerfield, has committed up to $350 million in growth capital for the combined company, intended to support the anticipated commercial launch of a new drug for which Posen hopes to soon receive U.S. Food and Drug Administration approval, and for future acquisitions. The new company will be led by CEO Adrian Adams, who replaced Placeka. And finally, in a section called Big Numbers, $1.17 billion. What Durham drug developer Parian Sciences could receive in the best-case scenario of a licensing deal reached with Boston-based Vertex Pharmaceuticals. Vertex paid Parian $80 million upfront to license Parian's experimental cystic fibrosis treatment, but the deal's true value of more than $1 billion could happen if treatments show positive efficacy in treating CF and are ultimately approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. $2 billion. Revenue last fiscal year for Durham-based Patheon, which filed June 8 to test the public waters through an initial public offering. Patheon's fiscal year ended October 31, and it reported an operating loss of $308 million on the year. The company has nearly $2.5 billion in long-term debt. Patheon employs 8,700 and contractors worldwide, including 5,100 employees in North America and 170 at the Durham headquarters. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, ABC's Secrets and Lies chooses Hollywood over North Carolina. A Wilmington-based television show scored $1 million in tax credits for one episode's worth of work in 2014, but it wasn't enough to keep it and its jobs in the state. Just a year later, ABC's Secrets and Lies is reportedly moving to California. The show didn't request a piece of the $10 million grant North Carolina split between its incentivized productions this year, according to state records, but in return for spending about $4.6 million on its pilot episode, the production company was able to submit a claim for more than $1.1 million in tax credits to the North Carolina Department of Revenue. And as that was only one episode, Guy Gaster, director of the North Carolina Film Office, points out that it will likely claim additional credits since it filmed 10 episodes in North Carolina. The show's departure proves what, for all the controversy, the film industry has always known, that tax credits don't ensure jobs in the long run. It's a completely different process from the economic development incentives also being rallied in the legislature right now. Take the incentivized 2013 promise of Deutsche Bank. The institution promised to have 431 new employees on the payroll in Cary by 2016, a milestone they've already reached. In exchange, the state offered up to $5.5 million via the Job Development Investment Grant, JDIG, program. Gaster points out that it's not an entirely fair comparison, pointing out that with film projects, there's the potential for auxiliary industries to benefit, specifically tourism. And film projects aren't as expensive to state and local infrastructures as large-scale facilities, such as those operated by Deutsche Bank. They're not really using those services and that other taxes would go toward paying, he says. While Secrets and Lies didn't file an employment number, Gaster points out that a typical show can run up to 500 employees an episode, but many of those employees follow a show when it leaves. Season by season is the way the incentives have always worked, including the grant program initiated this year. We hope to have a good relationship with the production, especially with a TV series that films multiple seasons, Gaster says, but it happens. Employees at firms such as Deutsche Bank have other opportunities should their job cease. In a tech-rich environment like the Triangle, it's not uncommon for technology workers to move on to a competing employer. But since the incentives expired, North Carolina is seeing less interest in film projects, meaning less options for crew members who find that their show is leaving the state. North Carolina wins battle for German firm. Quietly, the U.S. subsidiary of German vacuum technology manufacturer Schmalz has been growing in Raleigh, so much so that it's outgrown the 20,000-square-foot facility it operated from since 2009. The company, which broke ground at its new 6-acre campus on Oak Forest Drive June 9, was offered incentives to move its 34-person local operation to South Carolina. The Midwest and other parts of the state, says company president Volker Schmitz, but he also says he never intended to move the firm from Raleigh. The new facility, located 2 miles from the current site, will allow the firm to grow at 100 employees in the next 10 years. Schmalz creates automation equipment used in manufacturing, such as clamps. Wi-Fi expansion. The hardest part about building an outdoor Wi-Fi network? Figuring out where it should go. That's according to Rob Serbone, Vice President of Wireless Product Management for Time Warner Cable, speaking after the company announced it was expanding its outdoor Wi-Fi hotspots to customers in the Triangle. The hotspots allow TWC customers to access Wi-Fi on the go, a service necessary because of the rise of data usage outside the home, says Serbone. And they are being deployed in what TWC calls its Max Markets, markets where TWC's highest speed service, TWC Max, is becoming available. Here are some locations where the service has already been deployed. Crabtree Valley Mall, Raleigh. North Hills Shopping Center, Raleigh. Capitol Boulevard Town Center, Raleigh. Cameron Village, Raleigh. Hillsborough Street, Raleigh. Downtown Chapel Hill area. Around NC State University. Area around UNC Chapel Hill, area around Duke University, and Main Street, Clayton. And finally, in a He Said It section, it's not a finished issue. We're basically continuing as before, expanding slowly in the areas we're allowed to expand, and we're hopeful that we'll be able to expand outside of Wilson County. And that was from Will Acock, General Manager at Greenlight Community Broadband, the municipal internet service in Wilson, speaking a month after North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper confirmed he'd filed a suit against the FCC seeking to overturn its decision to allow Wilson to expand the service. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Transportation page, written by Jeff Jeffrey. The main headline, RDU runway replacement among top Triangle projects in state transportation plan. State officials have signed off on a 10-year transportation improvement plan that would see nearly 1,100 projects move forward over the next decade, roughly 200 of which would be in the Triangle. Among the largest projects included in the plan is the $100 million runway reconstruction at Raleigh-Durham International Airport, which is scheduled to begin in 2020. Airport officials have said wear and tear on the runways over the past 30 years will require them to be replaced in the near future. Runways typically get about 40 years of use before the concrete needs to be replaced. Ours are about 32 years old, RDU Chief Operating Officer William Sandifer said during a recent interview. The plan also includes the construction of a new $1.4 billion freeway near Southeast Raleigh that would eventually become NC 540. Other big-ticket items in the Triangle include an $88.1 million extension to I-85 that would take it to the eastern border of Durham County, and a $37.7 million expansion of I-40 in Wake County. The plan also includes renovating or replacing dozens of bridges and roads in the Triangle counties. NCDOT spokeswoman Nicole Meester says the 10-year plan assumes the state will continue to receive its current level of federal funding. She says NCDOT staff did not attempt to factor in the current fight in Congress over whether and how to extend the Federal Highway Trust Fund. We make decisions based on the best information that is available at the time, Meester says. If changes were to occur at the federal level, then we would have to look at how we schedule our short-term projects, but we wouldn't necessarily change how we schedule 10 years out. Meester says the plan assumes NCDOT will have a budget of $15 billion over the next decade, which includes federal funds. If federal funding amounts were to change, Meester says the department would amend the 10-year plan to either add or take out projects to be in line with the adjusted federal levels. The North Carolina Board of Transportation updates its 10-year plan every 2 years. The current plan charts NCDOT's construction schedule through 2025. Meester says the plan was created after NCDOT received proposed projects from municipalities and other interested parties from across the state. The projects that were submitted totaled between $60 billion and $65 billion, so we were only able to approve about 18% of those based on our current level of funding, Meester says. Governor Pat McCrory has proposed increasing state transportation funds by way of a $1.4 billion bond proposal. The funds raised by the sale of those bonds would cover the cost of 27 highway projects across the state. A second $1.5 billion bond proposal would cover the cost of renovating older state buildings that can be saved and building new, more efficient ones when they cannot. The bonds would be paid back over the next 20 to 25 years. McCrory has been meeting with state lawmakers and business leaders, hoping to gain support for the bond proposals. And along with this article, we also have a by-the-numbers look at the NCDOT plan. 1,100, the total number of projects statewide that were approved by the board. 200 plus, the number of Triangle projects included in the 10-year plan. $15 billion, NCDOT's anticipated budget through 2025. $1.4 billion, cost of a new freeway near Southeast Raleigh that would eventually become NC 540, and $100 million, cost of replacing runways at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the A Better World page written by Todd Cohen. And first we start off with the Todd Cohen's column, the headline, Local Food Hub Sprouts in Durham. Connecting local farmers with people in need, adding a missing link to the local food supply chain, reviving a distressed urban corridor, and boosting the local economy are the goals of a new food hub set to open by mid-June on the north side of downtown Durham. Developed by Reinvestment Partners, an advocacy and community development nonprofit that has invested $2 million since 2007 in 17 projects radiating from the intersection of East Gear and North Roxborough Streets, Bull City Cool will house two tenants in a 4,200-square-foot building at 902 North Mangum Street. Operating in the building, which began as a Gulf gas station in 1928, will be Bella Bean Organics, a business that buys local food and products and makes home deliveries, and Farmer Food Share, a nonprofit that helps get fresh food from local farmers to local agencies that serve food-insecure individuals. It's going to revitalize the neighborhood, Peter Skillern, executive director of Reinvestment Partners, says. It's going to help local farmers. It's going to feed hungry people. Reinvestment Partners, which has raised $600,000 for the project, expects the hub will help Bella Bean Organics and Farmer Food Share double the combined volume of food they handle in about 2 years and eventually generate a total of $2 million a year in business, Skillern says. Formed in 2009, Farmer Food Share has been operating at a small warehouse on Hood Street in Durham, just off East Main Street. Operating with an annual budget of $360,000, up by half from last year, the nonprofit runs donation stations at 25 farmers markets in 8 counties throughout the state that in 2014 collected 55,000 pounds of fresh produce from vendors and shoppers that it donated to local relief agencies to help feed more than 20,000 people in need. It also collected $32,000 in donations from shoppers that it used to buy food at the farmers markets for their local partner agencies. Farmer Food Share also operates a pop market, serving as an exchange that connects local farmers with food pantries and social service agencies that last year handled 80,000 pounds of fresh produce, totaling $120,000 in sales. The capacity for what we can move will dramatically increase, says Jeannie Bell, executive director of Farmer Food Share. The new processing center, where food can be stored, washed, dried, cut, and frozen, will allow Farmer Food Share to begin providing food for child care centers and school systems, which typically lack the staff or kitchen equipment to process food from local farmers, Bell says. Skillern says the food hub will serve as an intermediary that will build both supply and demand in the local food supply chain by adding processing capacity the region lacks, by raising money to buy food from Farmer Food Share and donate it to social service agencies, and by attracting more high-income customers for Bella Bean Organics. The food hub, he says, will increase our two current tenants' capacity to buy and redistribute food. And in nonprofit news, Carolina Kids Classic raises $113,000. UNC Chapel Hill head men's basketball coach Roy Williams and head football coach Larry Fedora presented a $113,600 check to the Ronald McDonald House of Chapel Hill. The money was raised at the Carolina Kids Classic, which was held June 2nd. Restaurants help Alex's Lemonade Stand. Volunteers throughout the Triangle will help raise money for Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, ALSF, an organization created in honor of Alexandra Alex Scott, 1996 to 2004, to help childhood cancer research. From June 12th through 14th, Firebird's wood-fired grill at the Park West Village Shopping Center in Morrisville will host lemonade stands, and throughout June, Flying Biscuit Cafe will donate a percentage of kids' meals sales to ALSF. Last year, Firebird's raised $50,000, and it hopes to increase that to $75,000. ESPN president gives to V Foundation. George Bodenheimer, longtime ESPN president, will donate all author royalties from his new book, Every Town is a Sports Town, Business Leadership at ESPN, From the Mailroom to the Boardroom, to the V Foundation for Cancer Research. Bodenheimer was hired in 1981. One of his early assignments was driving around network stars like Dick Vitale. He worked his way up to become ESPN's president from 1998 to 2011. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And first we have the guest column written by Blake Zalkberg, who is Chief Executive Officer of OFM, a Holly Springs-based office and school furniture manufacturer, distributor, and wholesaler with operations in Phoenix, Arizona. The headline on the guest column, Modern Workplace Can Be Anywhere. Not that long ago, work was a place. Now it's a state of mind. Picture a typical 21st century American worker standing at a subway stop texting a friend. I'm going to work, she writes. Then as the train pulls away, she reads news stories about her industry, sends emails to coworkers, and checks her calendar. When did she get to work? When she turned on her phone? Or when she arrived at a nondescript office building downtown and walked through the door? Our technology has dramatically changed the way we approach our jobs, but our terminology still lags behind. Laptops, smartphones, and tablets have liberated us from the cubicle, while email and chat programs have tethered us to our coworkers. When a worker can brainstorm new products with people in her department over email on the subway, win an important new contract while standing in line at Starbucks, and finish a key document from her living room couch, the office is everywhere. That means we need to rethink the purpose of the physical office, the place where we all meet to do work. It's no longer enough for today's companies to simply park their workers in cubicles or standard chairs and desks and show them where the bathrooms are. In some workplaces, that's led forward-thinking managers to tear down the cubicle walls and create open spaces. But those don't work for everyone, and more importantly, they don't address the underlying issue. Yesterday's office was like a factory. Each desk was done in a specific place. But today's offices need to be more flexible. For some companies, that might mean setting up different types of workstations for different kinds of work. Individual desks for everyday tasks, larger tables for collaborative projects, informal workspaces for couches for brainstorming, like couches for brainstorming. The change starts at the most basic level, the chairs we sit on and the desks we use. As the head of an office furniture manufacturer and distributor, I'm constantly looking for new ways to design office furniture to be more versatile and flexible. For example, we sell a chair and love seat that come with a built-in USB port and electrical outlets to charge your laptop, smartphone, or tablet, as well as a flip-up privacy wall that allows you to shut out distractions and have privacy when you need it. Other furniture companies are tweaking their designs too, creating individual pods where workers can set up shop for long stretches, or designing treadmill desks for people who don't like to sit still. Some of these ideas will catch on. Others are more useful as spurs to rethinking how to design the modern-day office. It will take some experimentation to figure out the office of the future. For now, we know some of the broad principles that should guide it. First, we need to offer employees more places where they can plug in, recharge, and get right to work as if they were sitting right at their desk. Everywhere in the office, from the break room to the boardroom, needs to be plug and play for workers who want to get on the internet, send email, or simply charge their battery. Second, we need to offer employees more types of places to work. That means traditional cubicles, standing desks, small tables, large tables, comfortable sofas, and things we haven't even thought of yet. When work is everywhere, because people can work anywhere, the office needs to be more than just another place. And in our final minutes, we'll read as much as we can from the People on the Move section. The spotlight is on Jackie Prilliman, Raleigh office managing partner at McGladrey LLP. Financial services industry veteran Jackie Prilliman has been tasked to lead the Raleigh office of accounting giant McGladrey LLP. Prilliman serves as a lead tax partner for the firm in Raleigh and focuses her efforts on middle market business leaders. She will continue that role in addition to her new office management role. As head of the Raleigh outpost, Prilliman oversees the office from a client service, people development, growth, and administrative perspective. McGladrey LLP provides assurance, tax, and consulting services focused on the middle market with nearly 8,000 professionals and associates in 80 cities nationwide. In the Triangle, the firm employs 109 people. What is one thing you wish people knew about your job? My job is very people-focused. Accounting is not just about numbers. Relationships with our clients, potential clients, employees, and our communities are key to a successful practice. What are some of your major goals in this position? To increase awareness of McGladrey and the Triangle as the leading service provider to middle market companies, create an environment where people desire to have a tenured career, and continue to build and expand our McGladrey specialized industry practices in the Raleigh office. Biggest pet peeve? Lack of respect for others. We all work hard and should be considerate of each other's time. People should be respected for their opinions and diversity. We don't have to always agree, but we can be respectful toward one another. Biggest worry? Like a number of industries, public accounting is finding it challenging to attract needed talent. That said, McGladrey offers flexibility and benefits that are of value to employees and listens to their input on an ongoing basis on how we can continue to make McGladrey a great place to work. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.